Thank you, Tim. Now I'd like to welcome our speaker, Carla R. from Tujunga, California.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name's Carla, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm just delighted to be here with you guys. I'm trying to put you back on gallery view, so I'm not looking at myself. I want to thank Annette for the invitation and opportunity to come out here and share with you guys today. It's just a grand lineup of speakers, and I'm grateful to be a part of it. And I've heard some good friends share already, and people that I admire and respect, and just delighted to be here. I want to give you one caveat already. My husband and I bought the good internet about a month and a half ago, and ever since we've been frozen and freezing and having all kinds of problems. So they've overpromised and underdelivered, and I know what that's like to do. I try not to do that anymore. But if that happens and I freeze, I'm just going to run out and get on my husband's computer. He's on with us, and so if you'll indulge me 30 seconds, I'll get out there as fast as I can. Anyway, my sobriety date, September 25th, 1987. I want to thank some of my dear friends that I see have hopped on to support me. I still get amazed and delighted at the people that come into my life and it really sometimes seemingly randomly and I laughingly but maybe secretly, you know, have a tiny secret concern that one day they're going to find out who they've really got, and they're going to go ahead and turn around and say, whoops. But so I'm going to enjoy it while it's lasting. And anyway, I don't know why, if you're new, I want to welcome you. And, you know, what I tell you what they told me, you're in for the ride of your life. I'm not going to lie. This thing, man, they told me to keep my hands and arms inside because everything is going to change. You know, you're going to change, things going to change. We're going to learn how to live with the changes and that's what we're going to do, you know. And one of my sponsors, Lee, used to say that it's not a requirement to like everything I had to do. It's just a requirement that I do it. I got used to that. Like that, that has served me well, because getting comfortable with being uncomfortable all these years later, it still serves me when it's time to learn something or time to go through something that I'm just not that, you know, thrilled with it at first glance. So here I am. And I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I'm just glad that I know that I am. I would have told you it was my crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family. It made me an alcoholic. But, you know, the trouble with that is then I started meeting people who live charmed childhoods, you know, and they just completely obliterate that myth, you know, like people like my husband who, you know, he grew up the only boy with a bunch of sisters. He was treated like a prince. He always felt great. He was talented, you know, life went his way, la, 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 la. You know, he has that whenever something happened in their family, you know, they gathered together and supported each other and sang together. Oh my God, I still get a little bit of a sugar headache when we, you know, after a family event, because they're just so sweet, you know. And yet he sits right next to me in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why? Because alcohol did exactly for and to him what it did for and to me. And I discovered it early and he discovered it a little later in life. And I know that a lot of people, you know, come in here having built and lost great empires in Alcoholics Anonymous, varying degrees, you know, of success. I'm not talking about, you know, squandering success. I'm just talking about they made something of their lives. They came in with a level of maturity that I just didn't have. I like to say that I peaked out at about 11 and a half and skittered across the bottom till I was 29. And then I got here. You know, it doesn't really matter. What matters to me, I think, for me, in my own experience and the way that I identify and what keeps me here, is what I believe is the best description of alcoholism that still exists on page 44 in the big book. And if this happens, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, because it doesn't matter then what the consequences or circumstances were. And it's been said over and over already, there's a bottom below the bottom we know. And like Darren said last night, you know, my bottom wasn't how bad things got necessarily, because the bottom that got me sober was not as bad as many of the circumstances that I had been through before I got sober. But it was the moment I turned left and started doing something else. When I picked up that kit of spiritual tools that was laid at my feet and started taking the steps, sometimes things were happening, like Ronald just said, before I ever took a step, but I was, something big was happening. But page 44, if when you honestly want to find you can't quit entirely, or if when drinking have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. Boom. Man, that's, does that happen? If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer. Boom, solution. That's simple. And so to that end, that's why I'm here. And it reminds me that I will never be so spiritually fit, because they told me when I was new, that you're going to have to change everything. Everything is going to change. Everything about you is going to change, whether you allow it or set the conditions for it to happen or whatever it is, you're going to be changing. But I need to remember 35 years later, 34 and a half years later, that I will never be so spiritually fit that I can take a drink of alcohol in any form at all, not mouthwash form or cough medicine form or food form. I don't know who puts food in their alcohol. I just know I've heard that people do. So I just don't do that. And what keeps that at the forefront of my mind is working with new people. Because I have seen people who have forgotten that. I have seen people who have forgotten that first half of the first step, that reason for the context of Alcoholics Anonymous, that this allergy of the body that I have, that only about 10% of the population has, this relationship with alcohol, this whirlpool that I got caught in, where I ended up in that horrible state of alcoholism, where I was either drinking or thinking about drinking all the time. And I believed in God. I had had a relationship with this power that I got to be reconnected with all these years later. But since I was a small child, I felt that sense of something bigger with a capital SB. You know, I felt that, and I loved it. I relished it, and tried to grow that. But when alcohol came along, it just became the great counterfeit. You know, it just slid right in there and gave me the illusion that it was doing the work, that, you know, quickly, that the others, that having that God and trying to grow up through on my own was just not, you know, just not fast enough. Alcohol was so much quicker than a prayer, you know, and trying to figure out what God's will was. So I let alcohol take over, and it became my spirituality, and it became my growing up muscle. It became the thing that made me feel buffered from you, and the thing that made me feel connected to you all at the same time. Why wouldn't I drink that? And that doesn't happen for everybody. I think it's hysterical, the difference between alcoholic and non-alcoholic drinking. You know, an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic go to a party, and the host opens the door, and the host says, "Sorry, we just ran out of booze, but come on in anyway." The alcoholic's going to just freeze in our tracks, right? Like, do I have some in my purse? Do I have some in the trunk? Is there a store nearby? Where can I get some booze? And the non-alcoholic's just going to walk in the house and go, "Cool, where's the food? Where's the dancing? Where's the people?" You know, they're going to just walk right in. They're going to be fine. The access to alcohol just doesn't hit them like somebody who has alcoholism does, because it did so much for me. And it did so much for me that I let it do to me. Even in the last couple of years when it was trying to throw me away, I was like holding onto its ankle, because I just didn't know if there was anything. Have you a sufficient substitute? That's a question that rang through my soul when I got here. Is this going to work? When I got to AA, I wasn't sure you weren't just some one more place that was going to make big promises, and then at some point I was just going to have to leave because it wasn't going to be enough. But almost 35 years later, my husband likes you to know he's like almost 4 months sober, longer sober than I am. I just think he needed the head start. But in any case, in September, I'll be 35. And I trust that if I continue to take the actions that I take and keep the attitude that I have, that I'll be able to do that. I know it's God's will, and I just have to cooperate with it. Anyway, you know, there was a lot going on at home, and I left home early, and I still believe it was for me to leave home, even though I jumped from the frying pan into the fire for a while. Um, and uh, and started getting arrested and out of school, truant, and at those houses, the party houses, and at the city jail then. And, you know, my mom, if I'd lived with my mom the whole time, it probably would have been a whole different story. She loved alcohol, loved the party, you know, all of the things that I was doing were not as consequential to her as they were my father. He's an untreated Al-Anon to this day. And alcohol scared him to death. Grew up with a violent alcoholic. And lived with that kind of abuse. And man, it just, you know, he was not going to have any of that. And so I left home and I ended up in San Francisco learning how to turn tricks. I was in the district of North Beach and then wandered down into the Tenderloin. And the reason I know I was in the Tenderloin is because people kept saying, how did you end up here in the Tenderloin? So I was 14 years old and that was not like on my list of things I wanted to be when I grew up. It's not that I'm against sex or even sex for money, if that's working for you. It just wasn't where I was headed, you know, thought I was headed. I wanted to be the first woman Major League Baseball player and the first woman to run a 4-minute mile and the first woman president. You know, I had big dreams and yet my life had taken a wide left turn listening to the whispers of alcohol. And I had a real relationship with this, the great counterfeit that made me think that I was working through all the stuff that I wasn't. That's what I'm left with when the alcohol's gone. I'm left back with the human condition. I don't think it's all alcoholism, because I know people who never drank have some of the same difficulties that I have, you know, but they grew up or they found some other little weird way to overcome and they got to deal with that too. But alcoholism was this definite relationship with alcohol that. And I don't do any, just to, you know, be sure, I don't do any recreational heroin or any afternoon crank either, you know, that would impair me. And while I had a relationship with all of that stuff early on, it was alcohol I couldn't let go of. I could not let go of the alcohol. And so I was locked up most of my adolescent life and in one place or another, a mental hospital for a year. And I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks and I ended up just moving on in and making myself at home, really. You know, they were giving me daily nutritional supplements, Thorazine, Melorel, Valium, Dalmain sleepers. I suppose they were concerned I wouldn't sleep. And I had become intimately familiar with 5-point restraints. And that's what I looked like at 15. I got busy in a lot of ways in that hospital and ended up going over the wall and juvenile hall in between, and then a rehab at Norwalk State Hospital. Here's how things change. It was a rehab based on the model of Synanon, when Synanon was actually working out there on the coast, Santa Monica. Like they had such a good thing going for a while till the head started to drink, that they actually were making models of rehabs after them. And, you know, I never went at the front door of any of those places except for juvenile hall. The walls were just a little too high and ended up leaving a girl's home at the end of all of that, and hooked up with a boyfriend I met in the rehab. And I know that some of you can identify with that, you know, that's where they keep a lot of the partners in rehab. And so we headed off into happy destiny and we ended up, you know, I just became one of those drunks who used to sleep by the side of the road and called it camping. You know what I mean? Like I thought I was on a spiritual quest and I was a hobo, really, you know, and again, I was still spiritually inclined, but alcohol now was not facilitating anything. It was just in the way. And when all else failed, if there was a spiritual path laid out before me, if I got tired or it seemed like it was too hard, I could take a drink and all would be well. Or it would feel like it would be well, even though I'm living outside. And we ended up living in a tent in the mountains in Southern Oregon, and then moved over to the other side of north of Grants Pass, way up on top of a mountain. And we found this old mining claim on government land and this old log cabin that had no roof. And we threw a plastic tarp over the top of that and called it a skylight. And then the baby came. And by that time we were drinking homemade wine and moonshine because it was organic and much better for you, and still, you know, no different. And I had had enough therapy to know that, you know, I got pregnant and I had had enough therapy to know that you got to break the cycle of parenting. You got to become the parent you never had. You got to do it all differently. And, And I knew that inside my heart, but we all know that alcoholism doesn't care who you love. And by that time I was getting my clothes and shoes and the necessities of life out of a box behind a store in town. And I thought I was going to be a better parent than the one I had because I was delusional. And my daughter got in the way of one of our fights when she was about 10 months old. And I had to take her up the road where it's got to be better somewhere else. And I drugged that kid over three states. And my first legitimate work was in the bar business. And God, it never occurred to me not to drink on the job. Why else would you have that job? It just seemed to me to be cosmically efficient, you know. So we ended up down here in Southern California, and I was renting a room for my aunt in Covina, and I got a job out in Hollywood tending bar. And, you know, this was not a bad, lousy dive place to work. This was a great place, great boss, great people, great money. Any healthy person could have made a great living for her and her daughter doing what I was doing. And yet I'm the common denominator. And my daughter was almost 4 years old at the time. And every afternoon I'd kiss her goodbye and I'd take off for the bar in Hollywood and I'd get thirsty on the way. So I'd pull into my bar on the way to the bar and I'd have my afternoon shots of Cuervo and a couple of Bud Backs and drink them down. And it was brought to my attention a couple of years ago that only an alcoholic calls two shots of Gold and two Bud Backs, two drinks, but that's how we do it, right? And so I drank those down and then I'd get off the bar stool and head out to Hollywood and go do my shift till the wee hours of the morning and crawl home and start over again. And one afternoon I kissed my girl goodbye like I had been doing for months. And on this particular afternoon took off like I always had done and got thirsty and stopped at my bar on the way to the bar and had ordered up those shots of Gold and Bud Backs. And to this day, I don't know what was different on that day from the day before, except for 24 hours. Because I didn't hate the job I was going to. There was no drama or trauma going on that day. I didn't hate it. You know, it wasn't hard. You know, I was sitting on the bar stool and I drank those drinks. And this time I couldn't stop. This time the knowledge that I needed to get up off the bar stool and head off to work so that I could make a living for who I would have told you is the most important person in the world to me just wasn't enough to overcome the phenomenon of craving that happens once I start to drink. And Bill in the chapter, The Doctor's Opinion, says that anyone that leaves out this physical factor is in any description of the alcoholic that leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. This is a real thing. And this is something I pay attention to all these years later. Anyway, wasn't enough to get me off the bar stool that afternoon, nor was the knowledge that my little girl was sitting at home waiting for her mommy to come home so that we could play a little bit before we went to bed and wake up the next day and play a little bit again so that we could get on about our day and then I could start over. Wasn't enough to overcome the phenomenon of craving that happens once I start to drink. And if just don't drink would have worked, you'd have a different speaker today too, that's for sure. So I sat on the bar stool and I drank those drinks and this time I couldn't stop. And I ended up losing the job and losing the kid in one fell swoop. And for 4.5 years, every single day, my heart broke. Every single day, my heart broke knowing that that kid was in better shape where she was than with me. And I still couldn't stop drinking. It was not enough. It was not enough knowing that my daughter was better off where she was. And every day my heart broke and I drank anyway. I ended up marrying my drinking partner right about the time we should have split up. You know how that goes. And I kept thinking if I put my circumstances back together, you know, that if we did it, you know, got it all together and got the kid back and put it all together, it all would be better. And we just became the neighborhood entertainment. We used to settle our arguments with a shotgun. Whoever got to the gun first won. That's how we did it. And, you know, when I got my daughter back, you'd think that somebody like me might straighten up and fly right. You know, we all intellectually understand what exactly had happened. And I love that piece in the big book where in there is a solution. I think it's on page 25. But anyway, he says, you know, what are we going to do? Go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation, meaning I know what's going on here and I still can't stop. I am watching my life run through my fingers like water, and I still can't stop. And it wasn't always the times that I just set out to get drunk either. Lots of people can do that. Even non-alcoholics can set out to get drunk once in a while. They do, and they're very cute. They don't even try to be cool. You know, they just get drunk, and then they get up the next day and go on about it, take some aspirin and move on. But it was the times that I just wanted to have a couple so I could go to work. I wanted to be able to finish my shift. I was a bartender and I couldn't finish a shift. I'd have other people come over and wash glasses and pour drinks so I could go take a nap in somebody's car. You know, we'd call it training. And so it wasn't always those times that I set out to get drunk. It was the times that I wanted to just have a couple and get something done and then have a couple. I mean, mind you, I didn't want to, I liked what alcohol did for me. And I knew I was going to drink. I'd say I was an alcoholic. That's why I drink. But there were times I wanted to get some things done too. I wanted to be a functioning alcoholic and I still couldn't do that. So I've got the kid back and, you know, during the week, 5 days a week, I had one job, and that would be to go pick that kid up from school in the afternoon, right about 2:30 in the afternoon. It was a 10-minute drive each way, and I'd get in the car, and most days I'd make it. But this particular afternoon, I got in the car, and I headed on over to go pick up my daughter from school, most important person in the world. And this particular afternoon, I got thirsty. On my way over there, I got thirsty. And I know those are three words that send chills down the spine of every alcoholic that's recovered. We know what that means. I got thirsty and I can't stop. I got nothing that stops me from pulling in the driveway of that bar and bellying up there and ordering my drink. And then as I start drinking, I look at the clock and I think I got 45 minutes. So I'm going to have this one and then I'm going to go get her. And then as I drink that drink, I think, but maybe two, I might have time for two, probably got time for three at the most. And then four, somebody lines up the bar with empty shot glasses and I can't turn down a free one. So I'm going to have five and then six, and then I'm late. And I finally peel myself off the bar stool and I start heading on over to the school. And I get over there and I have to go into the front office because that's where they keep the kids whose parents can't get there in time. And the best defense is an offense. So I go charging into the office and I'm mad at the staff because I'm late. And as I go charging into the office, I trip over my own feet and I go rolling across the floor of the office where my daughter attends school. And she's standing there. And as I go rolling across the floor of the office where my daughter attends school, I catch a glimpse of her face and the look in her eye as she watches me. And I felt that sense of powerlessness, not the kind of powerlessness like, oh my God, I've got to go do something about this, but the kind of powerlessness like, oh my God, I am never going to change. I am always going to be like this. It doesn't matter where I am. I'm always going to be like this. And that kind of thing went on. So the best thing I could do was to grab her hand and get the hell out of there before somebody called the police like they were threatening to do. And that kind of thing happened over and over and over for another little over a year until finally one Saturday afternoon, the cops are in the driveway again. The kid's scared to death again. The neighbors are watching us again. We're living in this tiny little apartment. How we're still together, I have no idea, me and my husband. And I'm hanging on to my daughter by a thread. And the cops left, they took the gun, the husband left for the last time, and it was me and the kid and the booze, and I still couldn't stop drinking. And here's where a hard drinker might take a look at their life and say, you know, I'm really tired of this. A hard drinker might say, and I've seen them do it in the bar, you know, they're ordering soda water one day, and they're going, yeah, I couldn't control it, so I had to quit. And then they have a couple of tonic waters, and they play some Pac-Man, and they go back to work, like from the bar, they go back to work. And they're okay. You know, some hard drinkers might even have to go to detox for a week or two. They come back home, go back to work, have a story to tell if somebody asked them, and they move on with their life and they're fine. But me as an alcoholic, what I did was I just pulled the booze closer to the couch so I didn't have to keep getting up to get another drink. Because I drank through my circumstances. I drank through my drug addiction. I drank through homelessness, and I drank through the loss of my daughter. And I was getting ready to do it again. And my first sponsor told me if I wanted to affect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, that I might start by just counting the coincidences that happen in my life. You know, those situations that seem to fall together for the good of everybody without me having my hands on it. Coincidence. And I like that. You know, I never lost the belief in God or this thing I still call God. But any experience I had had become a real vague memory. And I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to connect like this, like I wanted to, like they kept saying. And so this coincidence thing, it seemed like a good place to start. And the first coincidence I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had seen and heard that whole deal go down that Saturday. And she came over a couple of days later and she brought me a big book and a 12 and 12. And she just sat on my couch and she told me her story. She didn't point her finger and talk about me and all the crap she saw happen, you know, a couple of days before. She talked about her and her drinking. And in her story, I heard me and mine. And what was more was I thought about the year previous, you know, where I'd run into her in the parking lot and in the laundry room from time to time. And she wasn't drinking then either. And what really impressed me about that was that she didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking. And that got my attention. I don't know how you do that. All I knew is that when I had no booze and I had no steps or fellowship or God of my understanding, no sufficient substitute, I felt like you stripped the coating off my wires. I felt oversensitive and underloved, and I didn't know what you meant by that and why you looked at me that way. And my self-centered head would close in on me from there, so much so that even though I knew a little bit about booze, I knew I couldn't guarantee if I was going to have 2 or 22. I knew that. I knew that I no longer had to invite trouble. It just seems to come to visit unsolicited, doesn't it, Ronnie? Just boom, open the front door. There it is. So I didn't know how her 12 little thinly veiled Sunday school sentences were going to have any effect on me in the face of what I'd become. They just seemed a little weak, you know, and I felt like I'd tried them all before. But there was that desperation of the well whooped ass. That helped, you know, grace and willingness showing up, coming together. And I liked what she said, and I took a look at those books, but I didn't get sober that day. And it was about a week and a half later, I just didn't go back and buy any more booze. And exactly what I thought was going to happen happened. I shook it out. I got sick. There was no treatment left for me, though. The people have been trying to help me all my life. And so I sat in that little apartment by myself. My daughter was gone for a few days, thankfully. And I just didn't go anywhere. And by Tuesday, I shook it out over the weekend and into Monday and into Tuesday. And by Tuesday afternoon, I was stark raving sober. And I went back to my neighbor instead of the store. Just one more little wormhole of grace I cooperated with. And I believe that's what it was, because I believe that grace is always around us. But when I cooperate with it, it's up to me. God doesn't, I don't think God picks and chooses. I ended up on her doorstep asking her what to do. And she sent me up to a meeting in Sierra Madre, California, and that became my first home group. And still how I know I'm willing is when my feet are moving or not moving, depending on what was just suggested to me. She said, go to the meeting. I went to the meeting and I sat way back by the open door and the exit sign just in case. And I heard a lot of people talking to each other and, you know, like asking each other how they were doing, being very kind, you know, would you like a cup of coffee? How's that fourth step coming? Do you have a sponsor yet? Do you need a ride home? You know, then I heard somebody say, hey, Joe, how's your lawn? And I was a little bit moved, you know, it moved me a little bit. I thought, oh my God, could my life ever be so elegant and simple as to be concerned about a lawn? You know, it just sounded like hope to me. It had been a long time since I had felt, heard an image that pure, you know. It had been so much about scraping and hustling and holding on every day. God, could it ever be just about sitting on a porch smelling fresh cut grass one day? It sounded like hope to me. And like Ronnie said earlier, that hadn't taken a step yet. Something was happening. Something with the capital S was happening in that room and in me. And the secretary asked me to read that night at the end of the meeting. And I read, I took that page from her and I read it. And as I read, I came into the room just a little bit more, just like I do every time I say yes to something you asked me to do. Only now it's in me anyway. Even when the meeting doors close behind me, man, I hope I never take this for granted. When the meeting doors close behind me, I am still okay. Because what you gave me is inside me. It's not only in the room. You've installed it in me. And it goes with me wherever I am. There's not a place where I go where it's not. And provided that I make the effort, provided that I get up in the morning and I ask and I look and I watch and I from the very beginning, it asked me to start to look at things from an entirely different angle, that as when we draw near, God, this may psychic change, this awakening consciousness discloses itself to me. And the way it happens is by letting go of the things that are in the way. And it starts to ask me to look at it way back then. And then it gives me some specific ways to continue to do that all through. So there's never a step I'm not taking. There's never something that's not working in me, but I have to tap into that. So I had to drink one more time at 89 days. And as soon as I took that drink, I wanted what I had had just a few minutes earlier. And I had to finish the drunk, but I got to come in and about 24 hours later. And that's where the notion or the concept or the whatever came to me, that I'm going to have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. And I married it. I ate it up. I got it. And I called my sponsor, and thank God she didn't tell me, wrong answer, you know, too bad for you. You're done. You tried. And that's it. She said, I'll be there to pick you up. We're going to the book study tonight. And I went up there, and they didn't say I wasn't welcome either. They said, oh, will you come and make coffee with us on Tuesday? And I thought, dang, somebody's going to think I'm going to be here on Tuesday. and I came on the days in between. You know, I needed to be immersed with you. I had a lot of stuff had piled up inside active alcoholism, and that all needed to be peeled away, and corrective action taken for, and amends made, and I got to stay, and right about 9 months sober, that horrible obsession to drink alcohol was finally lifted for me, and it had been on me pretty good. You know, And meetings alone don't keep me sober, but meetings are where I heard about sponsorship and commitment and integrity and character, and that character is built in the dark when nobody's looking. It matters as much or more when nobody's looking that I do the right thing. I know. And mine is the head I walk around with. I know. So that's what I learned in meetings. And I love discussion groups, man. That's where I heard the old timers lay these principles over their lives, and then they share about it, you know, and where I learned that my dark past is my greatest asset, that somewhere along the line, everywhere I'd been and anything I'd done might be used to help somebody else. And I have to take a lot of that on faith, but I've seen a lot of that come to fruition over the years now too. Right about the 9 months also, I was making that first round of amends to my family. And, you know, I say first round because my family required a lot of follow-up. You know, there's to this day, there's not one member of my family who'll stand in the doorway and say, no, please don't go to the meeting. You know, they never do that. Nor does any member of my family ever have to wonder where I am or don't I love them or why can't they find me? That doesn't happen either. And other people started asking me to sponsor them. And I got to tell you, I know no better way to say it, but the only fifth step I like better than mine is yours. Because in your eyes, I see redemption and forgivability and lovability and hope and growth where I don't always see it in myself. You know, you draw from me things I didn't know I needed to share, and you share with me things I didn't know I needed to hear. And not just in formal inventories, but on the way to the meeting and over the phone and over coffee and all of those times, you know. We knit ourselves closer together with these Me Too moments, and we encourage each other to keep going. After a couple of years, I'd had you guys, and my daughter didn't have anybody. She was one angry 11-year-old, man. She had joined a gang, and she was starting to come home at all hours of the night, beat up and bloody if she came home at all. And, you know, just she was in trouble drinking and using, and we just didn't know. And all that was going on with her. And so I ended up putting her in a treatment center, And I didn't know if that was the right thing to do, but she was there 6 months, and I showed up when they asked me to, and I stayed away when they asked me to. And little by little, we started that sobriety cha-cha, you know, three steps forward, one back, one forward, three back. And it took from the time she was 11 till she was about 23 for us to right that ship, you know, and And they told me back then that the gang influence was 1,000 times more toxic on kids that age than drugs and alcohol. Now, I don't know if the stats on that are accurate, but I do know that with her, it was the family, it was that feeling of family, and I got your back. And she did, you know, I was busy being wonderful in Alcoholics Anonymous. First, she lost me to alcohol. Now she's lost me to AA. And right up front in our book, it doesn't even hide it. Page 19, it says, a more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. So if I'm only doing it in these rooms, I'm only half doing it. And it was time for me to go to work, go home, be a mom to that kid, then go to the meeting, you know, and yeah, I didn't have to keep going to 2 and 3 meetings a day anymore. It's time to change. And, you know, we get these cues and so when she was 16, she came home and she and her boyfriend had a funny look on their face. And I told them they were pregnant and they nodded. And I got to tell her that I'll be there no matter what you decide. And I got to be present at the birth of my first grandson. And that kid just started his job as a practicing attorney about 4 months ago. And my youngest grandson came along about 4 and a half, almost 5 years later. And he didn't want to go right back to college after high school. He wanted to go out and work. And so he's been doing that, working and making his way. And he's a really good young man as well. And so, you know, and I'm just gray-haired Grandma Carla, you know, that's who they know. They know that I'm an alcoholic, but they've celebrated my 20 year, you know, 20 and 25 year sober birthdays, 30 year sober birthdays, you know, that they've never had to know why. Their mother did. And their mother's just a terrific mom. And just a few years ago, I sat with my husband and my mended family. And we watched her collect her master's degree. And she became a social worker and now a therapist. And she's one of those people who's gone into the aftermath of things like the Las Vegas shooting and the San Bernardino Terrorist Act and sits with the families of the victims and helps them begin to put the pieces of their lives back together. That's who she is. And I don't know if she is who she is because or in spite of me, but I know that because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to be a privileged witness in her life and in the lives of anyone who wants to be in mine. And that's, man, that's amazing to me. When I was 5 years sober, I was raped by an intruder who came into my kitchen through my kitchen window into my room in my apartment that night. He had a knife, and thank God my daughter was off staying with her dad that week. And so it was just me, and I didn't hear him come up on me until it was too late. And he tied me up and he raped me and he robbed me that night in my room. And you know, it was a little startling. You know, you don't think, it's really funny that I don't even think we feel ourselves coming into that idea that nothing is ever going to happen to us because we're sober. I'm working 12 steps. Wait, haven't you heard? And I mean, not literally, but you know what I mean. And so he was there for a few hours and I tried to run for the door and the door stuck. So we ended up in this little altercation and instead of getting more angry, he dropped the knife and he went out the same window he came in. And it turned out that I knew him. I'd actually watched him get sober 30 days before I did. And I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids and everything back. And then I watched him join the church and leave AA behind. And when he went out, that's what happened. And what I chose to learn from that is that, well, the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right and to make use of what they offer. AA is where I learned the terms and conditions of my alcoholism. It's where I learned that no matter how spiritually fit I am, I can't go to the church picnic and have a glass of wine. You know, I learned that here. And then I can go out. We didn't make this stuff up. You know, Bill Wilson himself said, this is a synthesis of all the ancient traditions, all of the beautiful principles that have worked for thousands of years. Bill just somehow tapped into it and got together with other people who had the problem we had. So I can go anywhere out there and practice spirituality, a Buddhist temple, a Saturday synagogue, a Sunday sermon. But what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous is we take spiritual principle and we aim it right at alcoholism. That's what we do here, in here. And then I can go anywhere I want to and worship or practice or whatever. Or, you know, there's some pretty good suggestions inside the big book too. But inside even the 11th step, it says, go on out there and see what they got. You know, I think it's a misconception that too bad they don't have what we had. They had what we have long time before. And so, you know, So we're just lucky we got it too now. There was a trial that followed. And as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys I'd known years before get up and testify as to who I used to be and like kind of like a big public fifth step. And so, you know, we had to get a character witness for me. And by that time I was working right alongside some really accomplished people at a big financial investment firm downtown LA, a place I never would have walked in the front doors of years before, would have had no business being there. And now, you know, I'm showing up and doing what they asked me to do, and I'm growing and growing up. And so the division head there volunteered to come and testify as to my character. And I guarantee you, when I first got here, you could not use the words Carla and good character in the same sentence. And he's there to tell them I'm okay, you know, and they told him all about who I used to be. And he said, I don't know about that. He said, but she shows up early and she stays late. And she was where she said she was. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. And then it was my turn to testify. And up until then, my sponsor and I had been talking about forgiveness and, you know, that I've got to find a way to allow forgiveness here. And forgiveness doesn't come from me, it comes through me, but I set the conditions and I have to be willing to look at this from an entirely different angle. And the guy had scared me. And anger at 5 years of sobriety was still my favorite way to deal with fear like that. But anger, if it's not transformative, it will just fester in me. And so I had to find a way through. And the seven-step prayer became my mantra in that, really. It just helped me get from point A to point B. And then what happened was I was sitting in the witness stand and I looked out and I saw him sitting at the defense table. And I realized that's a place where I've sat before and I could sit again. Haven't I sat where he sat? And couldn't I sit where he's sitting? Or am I right now so full of self that I'm roaring through the lives of others like the proverbial tornado somewhere in my life right now? You know, and those questions in the turning point, you know, what I like to call the turning point on page 67 in the middle of our resentment inventory, you know, though I didn't like their symptoms and the way these disturb me, he, like me, is spiritually sick. Haven't I done what he's done? Or haven't I sat where he sat? Maybe not rape, but something equally as destructive. Couldn't I go off the rails and sit where he's sitting again? Or am I right now? And that kind of 10 step, yeah, that kind of inventory in my 10 step still slows me down. When I'm getting ready to point the finger at you all these years later, I look at you, and even though the resentment or fear is so delicious and justified, you know, it slows me down. Haven't I done what you've done? Haven't I sat where you've sat? Couldn't I again sit where you're sitting? Or am I right now doing what you're doing somewhere in my life? And it slows me down. And loosens my grip on whatever. And what happened for me in that moment was we became two alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. The forgiveness came and the healing took a while longer. And those two I found were different. And I found that it was for me to testify and it was for me to forgive. And it was possible. And I found out by walking through it. I don't know if you could have explained that to me before and had me fully understand it. And then, you know, when we're going into steps six and seven, whenever I realize that your symptoms disturb me and the way that the symptoms and the way they manifest disturb me, when I realize that I've got them, man, it gives me the seeds of compassion. It gives me an ability to know if life is this hard for me, I know it's got to be hard for you too. And then we're back on the same playing field. We're back standing on the same ground. And it calms me down and loosens my grip on how I think things are supposed to be. And I know I'm getting to the edge of my time here. So I'll just, you know, he was convicted and he was given 20 years and he did 12 and then he did 3. And I know that it works in prison if it's worked. I know it works wherever it's worked. You know, if we're willing to take the actions, it doesn't matter where we are. And we have seen miracle after miracle after miracle in prison, in county jail, and then on the street that this works if we work it. The detective who worked the case came to me after it was over and he said, I don't know who you were back then. I'm not even sure I want to know, but whatever it is you're doing now, keep doing it because it seems to be working. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. We didn't know it at the time until the trial was over. And I'm really glad we didn't, but the judge had been a long sober recovered alcoholic and the court reporter was the Al-Anon mother of a woman in my home group. So the 12-step fairies had thoroughly dusted the room before we got there. And, you know, people from my home group came, my sponsor came, my father was in that trial, and my sponsees, and I didn't have to walk through that alone if I didn't want to. The first maybe 15 years of my sobriety was filled with lots of drama, you know, stuff I brought and stuff that happened and mistakes I made. I was bankrupt at 10 years of sobriety, making a big mistake about a job I took and getting into that. And I was floored by the time I got out of there. And the only thing I can say is that in every challenge that has happened in my sobriety is the one thing that has happened is I've allowed it to drive me further in, not out. It drives me in, not out. And people like Vince Yeo used to say, you can't be afraid to look bad in Alcoholics Anonymous. And maybe a little rougher said, but when I was brand new, they said, you can't save your ass and your face at the same time. And I'm okay. I get that. And so I just bring it in. And then I've got to do some work. And, you know, I got to continue. Mine is a head I go home with. And so acting better than I feel gets me a certain place. But then I've got to do some writing. I've got to do some real work and share it with a sponsor. Or by now I have some pretty good friends who've been around a long time and they know what we're doing here. And they'll tell me the truth when I ask them. So moving on. Every morning my feet hit the floor and I say thank you. I say this little prayer my sponsor gave me, and she says I remembered it wrong. So now I guess there are two, but I ask God to grant me the heart of a grateful servant, and that makes me feel joyful. And then I sit in meditation, and then I sit in meditation with the group. And I've always avail myself of a lot of spiritual texts. It doesn't matter where they come from. The truth is the truth is the truth. And I am still fascinated with the great mystery with a capital M. I'm fascinated with it. And I get to enjoy it when I'm shoulder to shoulder with you. So I wanna thank my husband for being on call. I thought I was gonna have to run out and get on his computer, and I love him so much. You know, we're kind of like a backwards country Western song. You know, we got the house and the truck and the dog, and we're still in love, and like, we're just going to keep marching on that way. And I want to thank you all so much for having me out here today. Keep coming back. Thanks.